In the green room, Jenny wrapped her legs around a chair and hung a glass of beer in the air next to her.
"Used to be it would fall slowly down to the floor," Jenny said, pointing at her drink. "They stripped most of Vesta's mass for the ring. It's barely a shell here."
Daka shoved a foot in a wall strap and settled in perpendicular to Jenny. She swirled the whiskey glass around in the air. Despite the glass being designed for zero gravity, her practiced flip of the wrist tossed several globules free that very slowly wobbled their way through the air toward her.
"We're passing into final stage preparations for the ring. SDC MME is panicking a bit because the projections for energy and the initial test results don't match, and the computers are having trouble managing stable orbits."
The glitter ring was a Dyson ring, a necklace of solar power stations and sails built around the sun to capture a vast percentage of its energy. The power needs of the big planets had begun to outstrip the large planetary solar and mirror arrays 100 years ago. Overflight and shadow rights for solar gathering stations had started turning into a series of low-grade orbital economic wars. The charter had been created to handle the problem system-wide. Build a ring of solar power catchments in orbit around the sun at a slight angle to the plane of the solar system. No current solar rights would be abridged, but it could catapult humanity into a new industrial era, a great leap forward. Unlimited, unabridged power.
"But if it didn't work?"
Daka nodded at all the serious faces.
"Don't look so glum. The cohort programmers are working on flocking algorithms to try and simplify how the solar stations keep in orbit. Follow some simple rules about what's around you and let complex emergent orbits develop."
"I'm more worried about the differences in output," Jenny muttered. "While you've been in long sleep, they've been developing orbital stations out past Jupiter, with the assumption that there would be beamed power to follow. They're building mega orbitals throughout the system on the assumption that the ring's going to work. They've even started moving people off Earth into temporary housing in orbit."
"Temporary?"
Euclid asked from across the room, interrupting before Daka and Jenny got deep into numbers and words like exajoules, quantum efficiency, price per watt, and all the other boring crap. He'd cared intimately about that when he first joined the cohort. Now, not so much.
"We're talking bubble habitats with thinner shells than Vesta right now. They use a layer of water for radiation shielding, but they lack resources, and they're not well balanced. These orbitals have about a couple 100,000 people each, and they're rated to last 50 to 60 years.
Jenny shook her head, and Euclid was forced to stop seeing the 19-year-old Zippy and recognize the concerned 44-year-old she'd become.
"They're risking a lot."
"Why would anyone agree?" Vega asked. "It sounds like suicide."
"It's gotten worse on Earth. Far worse. Everyone is just expecting to hit the reset button after the glitter ring goes online. Everyone's holding their breath."
Daka spoke up.
"Okay, enough cohort bullshit. Let's talk about you. The band's heading back to long sleep soon. And then what, Zippy? You heading back to Mars and your daughter?"
Jenny looked around the room hesitantly.
"Lara's never been to Venus, and I promised her she could visit me. If you'll have me."
"If?" Vega laughed. "I hated playing those recordings of you. Rather hear it live."
"I'm not as zippy up and down the chords as I used to be, you know,"
Jenny warned. Everyone was turning to look at Euclid.
"It's a more confident sound," he said with a smile.
Daka whipped globules of whiskey at them and laughed.
Kumi beamed, no doubt already dreaming about meeting his granddaughter.
"Hey, Zippy," Euclid said. "Here's to change. Good change."
"Maybe," she smiled and slapped his raised hand in agreement and approval. "Let's dream on that."
The first few days after long sleep were never pleasant, but this awakening was the worst of Euclid's experience. He slowly remembered who he was and how to speak,
and the names of the people who sat quietly with him in the lounge after their sessions with the medics. For a while, they silently watched the high cities of Venus glinting in the clouds below their orbit from viewports near the long sleep pools. Later, they began to ask questions. Later, they realized that something was very wrong. They'd been asleep for 50 years. Two long sleeps, not the usual single sleep. "Everyone gone silent back on Vesta," Daka said.
"Did we get idled?" Euclid demanded. "They were a band, not workers. They shouldn't have been idled."
The medics didn't answer their questions. They continued to deflect everything until one morning an officer turned up, dressed in black sub-uniform with empty holster belt, as if he had left his weapons and armor just outside the door. He looked barely 20, far too young for the captain's insignia on his shoulders. He spoke with slow, stilted formality. "Mr. Slinger, Mr. Jancy, Mr. De La Vega, Miss Miriam, and Miss Baptiste, thank you for your patience. I'm Captain Abrams. We're sorry for the delay, but your recovery was complicated."
"Complicated?"
Kumi looked disgusted.
"Can you explain why we had two long sleeps instead of one? 50 years? We had a contract."
"And we had a war." The reply was unexpectedly sharp.
"Be glad you missed it."
"Our first interplanetary war?
That's not the change I wanted,"
Euclid muttered to Vega.
"What happened?"
Jenny asked, her voice barely a whisper.
"My daughter. She's on Mars. Is she safe?"
The officer glanced away in a momentary flash of vulnerability and guilt. "You have 2 weeks for news and correspondence with your cohort and others. We can provide political summaries and psychological care for your readjustment. After that, your tour begins. Transport down to the cities has been arranged."
I have to say, we still need you now, more than ever."
"The Ras?"
Kumi stared at the soldier, spreading his arms.
Again, that touch of vulnerability as the young soldier replied with a slight stammer.
"Please, we need you. You're legends to the entire system now, not just the cohorts."
"The hell does that mean?" Vega asked as the boy captain left. Jenny's daughter had managed one long sleep, but woke on schedule while they stayed in storage. The war was over by then, but Martian infrastructure had been badly damaged, and skilled workers were needed for longer than the standard year or two. Lara had died after 6 years of extra time, casualty of a radiation exposure accident on Dimas. They gathered around Jenny when she collapsed to her knees and wept, grieving for the child they had never known. Their correspondence was scattered across the years, their cohort truly broken as it had been forced to take cover, retreat, or fight. The war had started in Earth orbit after a temporary habitat split apart, disgorging water, air, and people into vacuum. Driven by desperation and fury, several other orbital inhabitants had launched an attack on SDC MME-owned stations, seeking a secure environment to live and revenge for their dead. Conflict became widespread and complicated. The orbital habitats were either negotiating for refugees, building new orbitals, or fighting for the SDC MME. Mars got involved when the government sent its military to protect the Martian investment in the SDC MME. Jupiter, which was now its own functioning techno-demarchy, had struck directly at the belt, taking over a large portion of the glitter ring. Millions had died as rocks were flung between the worlds and ships danced around each other in the vacuum. People fought hand-to-hand in civil wars inside hollowed-out asteroids, gleaming metal orbitals, and in the cold silence of space. Humanity had carried war out of Earth and into the great beyond. Despite the grim history lesson, as the band shared notes and checked their financial records, one thing became clear. They were legends. The music of the Mighty Slinger and the Rovers had become the sound of the war generation and beyond, a common bond that the cohorts could still claim, and battle hymns for the Earth immigrants who had launched out from their decayed temporary orbitals. Anti-SDC MME songs became treasured anthems. The Rovers' songs sold billions. The covers of their songs sold billions. There were tribute bands and spin-off bands and a fleet of touring bands. They had spawned an entire subgenre of music.
"We're rich at last," Kumi said ruefully. "I thought I'd enjoy it more."
Earth was still there, still a mess, but Vega found hope in news from his kin. For decades, Pacific Islanders had stubbornly roved over their drowned states in vast fleets, refusing resettlement to the crowded cities and tainted badlands of the continents. In the last 50 years, their floating harbors had evolved from experimental platforms to self-sustaining cities. For them, the war had been nothing but a few nights filled with shooting stars and the occasional planetfall of debris. The Moon and Venus had fared better in the war than Mars. But the real shock was the ring. According to DACA, the leap in progress was marked, even for 50 years. Large sections were now fully functional and had been used during the war for refueling, surveillance, barracks, and prisons. "Unfortunately, that means that the purpose of the ring has drifted once again," she warned. "The military adapted it to their purposes, and returning it to civilian use will take some time."
"But what about the assembly?"
Euclid asked her one day when they were in the studio, shielded from surveillance by noise and interference of Vega's crafting.
"Do they still care about the purpose of the ring? Do you think we still have a mission?"
The war had ended without a clear victor. The SDC MME had collapsed, and the board had been tried, convicted, and exiled to long sleep until a clear treaty could be hammered out. Jupiter, Mars, Venus, and some of the richer orbitals had assumed the shares and responsibility of the original solar charter. A tenuous peace existed. DACA nodded.
"I was wondering that too. But look, here's the name of the company that's organizing our tour."
Euclid leaned in to read her screen. Bisholti, Bisholti, and Abrams. Captain Abrams revealed nothing until they were all cramped into the tiny cockpit of a descent craft for Venus's upper atmosphere. He checked for listening devices with a tiny wand, and then, satisfied, faced them all. "The Bisholti family would like to thank you for your service. We want you to understand that you are in an even better position to help us, and we need that help now, more than ever." They'd come this far. Euclid looked around at the rovers. They all leaned in closer. "The Director of Consolidated Ring Operations and Planetary Reconstruction will be at your concert tonight." Abrams handed Euclid a small chip. "You will give this to him, personally. It's a quantum encrypted key that only Director Cutler can access."
"What's in it?"
DACA asked. Abrams looked out the window. They were about to fall into the yellow and green clouds. The green was something to do with floating algae engineered for the planet, step one of the eventual greening of Venus. Something Cutler won't like, or maybe a bribe, I don't know, but it's an encouragement for the director to consider a proposal.
"Can you tell us what the proposal is?"
"Yes," Abrams looked at the band. "Either stop the redevelopment of Earth and further cement the peace by returning the orbital's inhabitants to the surface, or..." Everyone waited as Abrams paused dramatically. "Approve a cargo transit across Mercury's inner orbit to the far side of the glitter ring, and give us the contracts for rebuilding the orbital habitats." DACA frowned. "I wasn't expecting something so boring after the big or there, Captain." Abrams smiled. "One small course adjustment at the start can change an entire orbit by the end of a journey," he said to Euclid. That sounded familiar.
either one of those is important? Euclid asked. But you won't say why.
Not even in this little cabin. I'm sure I got the bugs, but in case I didn't.
Abrams shrugged.
Here we are.
Ready to change the solar system, Mr. Slinger?
Venusian cities were more impressive when viewed from the outside. Vast, silvery spheres clustered thickly in the upper atmosphere, trailing tethers and tubes to the surface like a dense herd of giant cephalopods. Inside, the decor was sober, spare, and disappointing, hinting at a slow post-war recovery. The band played their first concert in a half century to a frighteningly respectful and very exclusive audience of the rich and powerful. Then it was off to a reception where they awkwardly sipped imported wine and smiled at their assigned liaison, a woman called Halford, briskly introduced and dismissed awestruck fans for seconds of small talk and a quick snap.
"And this is Peter Cutler," Halford announced, "Director of Consolidated Ring Operations and Planetary Reconstruction."
Bodyguards quickly made a wall, shepherding the director in for his moment. Cutler was a short man with loose, sandy hair and a bit of orbital sunburn.
"So pleased to meet you," he said. "Call me Peter."
He came in for the vigorous handshake, and Euclid had already palmed the small chip. He saw Abrams on the periphery of the crowd, watching. Nodded. Cutler's already reddened cheeks flushed as he looked down at the chip.
"Is that?"
"Yes."
Euclid locked eyes with him.
"The director. One of the most powerful people in the entire solar system."
Cutler broke the gaze and looked down at his feet.
"You can't blackmail me. Not even with this. I can't change policy." "So you still redeveloping Earth?"
Euclid asked, his tone already dull with resignation.
"I've been around before you were born, Mr. Slinger. I know how generational projects go. They build their own momentum.
No one wants to become the executive who shut down 200 years of progress, who couldn't see it through to the end. Besides, wars aren't cheap. We have to repay our citizens who invested in war bonds, the corporations that gave us tech on credit. The Earth Reconstruction Project is the only thing that can give us the funds to stay afloat." Somehow, his words eased the growing tightness in Euclid's chest.
"I'm supposed to ask you something else, then."
Cutler looked suspicious. He also looked around at his bodyguards, wanting to leave.
"Your people have big asks, Mr. Slinger. This is smaller. We need your permission to move parts across Mercury's orbit, close to the sun, but your company has been denying that request. The Rock Devil's cohort also wants to rebuild the surviving temporary Earth orbitals. Post-war security measures are still in place."
"Security measures my ass!" Jenny spoke so loudly, so intensely that the whole room went quiet to hear her.
"Jenny,"
Kumi started. "No. We've sacrificed our lives and our children's lives for your damn ring. We've made it our entire reason for existence, and we're tired. One last section to finish, that could finish in less than 3 decades if you let us take the shortcut to get the last damn parts in place and let us go work on something worthwhile. We're tired. Finish the blasted project and let us live."
Kumi stood beside her and put his arm around her shoulders. She leaned into him, but she did not falter. Her gaze stayed hard and steady on the embarrassed director, who was now the center of a room of shocked, sympathetic, judging looks.
"We need clearance from Venus,"
Director Cutler mumbled. Euclid started humming a quick backbeat. Cutler looked startled.
"Director,"
Euclid sang, voice low. He reached for the next word the sentence needed to bridge.
"Dictator."
How to string that in with something to do with the project finishing later. He'd been on the stage singing the old lyrics people wanted to hear. His songs that had once been extempo, but now were carved in stone by a new generation. But right here, with the bodyguards all around them, Euclid wove a quick song damning him for preventing progress in the solar system and making trouble for the cohorts.
That's right, Euclid thought. That's where the power came from. Singing truth right to Power's face.
Power reddened. Cutler clenched his jaw.
I can sing that louder, Euclid said. Loud enough for the whole system to hear it and sing it back to you.
We'll see what we can do.
Cutler hissed at him and signaled for the bodyguards to surround him and move him away. Halford, the liaison, congratulated the band afterwards.
You did it. We're cleared to use interior transits to the other side of the ring and to move equipment into Earth orbit.
Anything else you need us to do? Daka asked.
Not now, not yet. Enjoy your tour. Broadcasting planet-wide and recording for rebroadcast throughout the system, you'll have the largest audience in history.
That's nice, Euclid said vaguely. He was still feeling some discomfort with his new status as legend. I can't wait for the Earth concert, Captain Abrams said happily. That one will really break the records.
Earth?
Kumi said sharply.
Halford looked at him. After your next long sleep, for the official celebration of the completion of the ring. That can't happen without the mighty Slinger and his rovers. One last concert for the cohorts.
And maybe something more, Abrams added.
What do you mean, more? Euclid demanded, weary of surprises.
Halford and Captain Abrams shared a look. Delight, anticipation, and caution. When we're sure, we'll let you know, the captain promised. Euclid sighed and glared at the door. He nervously twirled a pair of virtual vision goggles between his fingers. Returning to Earth had been bittersweet. He could have asked to fly over the Caribbean Sea, but nothing would be the same. Coral reef islands reclaimed by water, new land pushed up by earthquake and vomited out from volcanoes. It would pollute the memories he had of a place that had once existed. He put the past out of his mind and concentrated on the present. The rovers were already at the venue, working hard with the manager and crew in technical rehearsals for the biggest concert of their lives. Estadio Nacional de Brasilia had become ENB de Abrams Bucholti, twice reconstructed in the last 3 decades to double the seating and update the technology, and now requiring a small army to run it. Fortunately, Captain Abrams, retired, knew a bit about armies and logistics, which was why Euclid was not at technical rehearsal with his friends, but on the other side of the city, waiting impatiently outside a large simulation room while Abrams took care of what he blithely called the boring prep. After 10 minutes or so, the door finally opened, and Captain Abrams peeked around the edge, goggles pushed up over his eyebrows and onto his balding head.
We're ready. Come in, Mr. Slinger. We think you'll like what we've set up for you.
His voice hadn't lost that boyish, excited bounce. Still holding his goggles, Euclid stepped into the room and nodded a distracted greeting to the small group of technicians. His gaze was quickly caught by an alloy-plated soprano pan set up at the end of the room.
Mr. Jancy says you were a decent pianist, Captain Abrams said, still brightly enthusiastic.
Was?
Captain Abrams smiled.
Think you can handle this one?
I can manage, Euclid answered, reaching for the sticks.
Goggles first,
the captain reminded him, closing the door to the room.
Euclid put them on, picked up the sticks, and raised his head to take in his audience. He froze and dropped the sticks with a clang.
Go on, Mr. Slinger. I think you'll enjoy this, Abrams said. I think we all will.
On the night of the concert, Euclid stood on the massive stage with his entire body buzzing with terror. The audience, packed into stadium tiers all around him, was a faceless mass that rose up several stories. But they were his family, and he knew them like he knew his own heart. The seats were filled with rock devils,
glad handlers, sunsiders, and more, all of them from the cohorts, workers representing every section of the ring and every year and stage of its development. Many of them had come down from Earth orbit and their work on the decaying habitats to see the show. Euclid started to sing for them. But they sang for him first, calling out every lyric so powerful and sure that all he could do was fall silent and raise his hands to them in homage and embrace. He shook his head in wonder as tears gathered in his eyes. Kumi, Vega, Daka, and Jenny kept jamming, transported by the energy, playing the best set of their careers, giving him a nod or a sweet smile in the midst of their collective trance as he stood silently crying and listening to the people sing. Then it was time. Euclid walked slowly, almost reverently, to the soprano pan at the center of the stage, picked up the sticks, just as he had in the simulation room, looked up at his audience. This time, he did not freeze. He played a simple arpeggio, and the audience responded, lighting a wedge of stadium seating, a key for each note of the chord, hammered to life when he hammered the pan. He lengthened the phrase and added a trill. The cohorts followed him flawlessly, perfected in teamwork and technology. A roar came from overhead as the hovering skyboxes cheered on the mighty slinger, playing the entire stadium like it was his own personal keyboard. Euclid laughed loud. Ain't seen nothing yet. He swept his arm out to the night sky, made it a good, slow arc, so he was sure they were paying attention. Then the other arm. Showmanship. Raise the sticks with drama. Flourish them like a conductor. Are you ready? Are you ready? Play it again. This time the sky joined them. The arc of the ring blazed section by section in sync with each note and in step with each cadence. The mighty slinger and his cohorts playing the largest instrument in the galaxy. Euclid grinned as the skyboxes went wild. The main audience was far quieter, waiting, watching for one final command. He raised his arms again, stretched them out in victory, dropped the sticks on the thump of the rover's last chord, and closed his eyes. His vision went red. He was already sweating with adrenaline and humid heat, but for a moment, he felt a stronger burn. The kiss of a sun where no sun could be. He slowly opened his eyes, and there it was, as Abrams had promised. The real last section of the ring, smuggled into Earth's orbit during the interior transits permitted by Venus, now set up in the mother planet's orbit with magnifiers and intensifiers and God knows what else, all shining down like a full noon on nighttime Brasilia. The skyboxes no longer cheered. There were screams. There was silence. Euclid knew why. If they hadn't figured it out for themselves, their earpieces and comms were alerting them now. Abrams Bushulte, just hours ago, had become the largest shareholder in the ring through a generation-long program of buying out rights and bonds from governments bankrupted by war. It was a careful, slow-burning plan that only a cohort could shepherd through to the end. The cohorts had always been in charge of the ring's day-to-day operations. But the concert had demonstrated beyond question that only one crew truly ran the ring. The ring section in Earth orbit, with its power of shade and sun, could be a tool for geoengineering to stabilize Earth's climate to a more clement range. Or a solar weapon capable of running off any developers. Either way, the entire ring was under the control of the cohorts, and so was Earth. The stadium audience roared at last, task accomplished, joy unleashed. Daka, Jenny, Kumi, and Vega left their instruments and gathered around Euclid in a huddle of hugs and tears, like soldiers on the last day of a long war. Euclid held on to his friends and exhaled slowly.
look like Massa Day done.
Euclid sat peacefully, a mug of bush tea in his hands, gazing at the cold metal walls of the long sleep hospice. Although the technology had steadily improved, delayed reawakening still had cost and consequences. But it had been worth the risk. He had lived to see the work of generations, the achievements of 1,000 years.
"Good morning, Baba."
One of Zippy's great-great-grandchildren approached, his dashiki flashing a three-dimensional pattern with brown and green images of some off-world swamp. This Baptiste, the head of his own cohort, was continuing the tradition of having at least one descendant of the rovers in attendance at Euclid's awakening.
"Are you ready now, Baba? The shuttle is waiting for you."
"I am ready," Euclid said, setting down his mug, anticipation rising. Every 100 years he emerged from the long sleep pool.
"Are you sure you want this?"
Kumi had asked.
"You'll be all alone."
The rest of the band wanted to stay and build on Earth. Curiosity had drawn him to another path. Fate had confirmed him as legend and griot to the peoples and assemblies of the post-ring era.
"Work hard. Do well. Baba will be awake in a few more years. Make him proud."
They had done well. So well that this would be his last awakening. The Caribbean awaited him, restored and resettled. He was finally going home to live out the rest of his life. Baptiste opened the double doors. Euclid paused, breathed deeply, and walked outside onto the large deck. The hospice was perched on the edge of a hill. Euclid went to the railing to survey thousands of miles of the Sahara. Bright feathered birds filled the air with cheerful song. The wind brought a cool kiss to his cheek, promising rain later in the day. Dawn filtered slowly over what had once been desert, tinting the lush green hills with an aura of dusty gold as far as the eye could see.
"Come, Baba. Let's go home."